Okay, so if you want to sit comfortably, we'll have a brief recapitulation of where we got to last week. So, Subhadramati started the course last week, this 3-week seminar on Beyond Ethics, by just introducing us to this notion of what beyond meant, and contrasting the notions that there's the beyond in terms of leaving something behind, when you go beyond something, and then there's the notion of a certain point at which beyond there is more, yes? And it's that type of version, in a sense, of beyond that we're looking at when we're thinking about beyond ethics. In a sense, we're not saying that that we're leaving ethics behind, but more that we've got a foundation, and then we go beyond in the sense of beyond willed action, a point at which ethics in Buddhist practice becomes spontaneous. A spontaneous, expression of the richness of experience, of the refinement of our minds. And to give that, to set it in context, Subhadramati started us off with this diagram of the notion of karma niyama processes and dharma niyama processes. So the niyamas being the natural laws which govern the universe from a Buddhist perspective, the expression of the natural world, the expression of conditionality through laws in the natural world. And particularly, I'm going to get up and just demonstrate a little bit. Please excuse me. It's easier if I point. So it's easier if you can see the diagram as well. It's kind of a good thing when you're meditating not to give anybody anything to be interested in other than their experience. The temptation would be to look at this and not at our experience. Or it would be a temptation for me anyway. So Nyanavacha a little while ago introduced us to the niyamas in this class, and I apologise if that's a new word for you or that's unfamiliar to you. But in short, they're the natural laws that govern experience, and the karma niyama arises at the point of self-awareness. That reflexive awareness of aware of being aware. So we have this diagram where we have this solid, and just to add as a corrective, this is simply a framework to give us a way of speaking about it. Please don't adopt this too literally. Yes, it's just trying to conceptualize the principle a little bit. So when we talk about a process, we're talking about something that's fluid, that's ongoing, it's not fixed. So we have the karma niyama processes rising up to indicate how through practice, through awareness, and through the practice of the precepts, the 5 or 10 Buddhist precepts or training principles, we can gradually work to refine our minds. But also, as we do that, we are aligning ourselves more and more with the way things really are in the universe, with reality, with the Dharma Niyama process. So we have the Dharma Niyama process coming down. And if you notice, there's a wiggly line going across here. And there's a point at which skillful action it doesn't stop, but it just stops being willed. There's a point at which skillful action, ethical action, is a natural expression of the refinement of our beings, the refinement of our mind. Okay? And we could think about it as, up until this point, it's possible to sort of leap about in all kinds of different ways or different levels of ethical awareness. We could sort of, right down here, just be observing the law of the land and not much else. You know, we're practicing within the law in order to keep out of trouble. Yes, so we could, it's sort of at our lowest self-awareness. We could just be practicing ethics out of fear, really. Yes? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And but if we were to, we might have a bit more of a conscience. Keeping out of prison might not be too difficult for us. Mm-hmm. So, and staying within the law might not be too difficult. In fact, for most of us, I'd suggest that if we're here, it's probably reasonably easy. So if we're refining our awareness, in a sense, we could be simply practicing cultural ethics, sort of observing the sort of more refined ways that we can observe ethics just by, in society, looking at the way, sort of the way culture happens, and just, observing the way we do things around here. Sort of holding doors open and, sort of basic acts of generosity as an example of sort of how you might observe cultural ethics. Things like, sort of marriage might come into that and, processes like that. I'm sure we can all think of things that might be more culturally led, just the way society works, really. And then we might come to the way we might come across Buddhism, conveniently. And we might then start to really work earnestly with our minds and our intentions. Okay? And we might also sort of take on to observe the 5 or 10 precepts or training principles. And in a sense, it's a path of irregular steps. On our good day, we can be wholly generous. We can really get out of the way and we can sort of commit wholeheartedly to being kind and sort of let go of ourselves a little bit. And then there are other days when then we just want to be firmly within our shell and nobody's getting anything out of us because we need to look after ourselves. And so in a certain sort of way, up until here, we can just be jumping around a little bit, depending on the day, depending on the quality of our mind, depending on how much metta, mindfulness that we have around. Does that make sense? Does everybody recognise that tendency? I certainly do. It actually takes quite a lot of mindfulness to stay ethical in terms of principles, in terms of working within the precepts. And what we're suggesting with this framework is that ethics is... So, welcome back. So to finish our brief recapitulation, last week, we started an exploration of the 3 mind precepts, and particularly last week we were looking at greed, the abstention from greed, or the abstention from covetousness and the movement towards tranquility, or non-greed, yes? And Subhadramati introduced us to that, and particularly the 3 poisons, if I'm understanding my work. Well, particularly the qualities of Alupa, which are, in a sense, one of the 3 things that keeps the wheel of life, the hub of the wheel of life spinning, and it's characterised, Alupa, is the positive counterpart. Lopa is craving, greed, and it's characterized by these qualities of desire and passionate attachment, and the craving, and yes, it's this real strength of desire. So, and really pointed to a state of intoxication. Intoxication with existence, intoxication with being, getting, selfing, that we are in our unaware state, really very much doing all the time. And so, if you introduce us to the notion of alopa, and not that one. Let's have a look, see if it's under here. There we go. And then just started to talk about the three root poisons, which you helpfully contributed yourselves. So greed, hatred and delusion. Or you could say craving, aversion, and, well, indifference or confusion. That keep ourselves sort of propelled in cycles of wanting, not wanting, or indifference in our lives. So we're going to move on this week to, we'll leapfrog to the 10th precept, the 10th mind precept, rather than look at devesha or hatred. We're going to be looking at delusion. And I wondered if we could start by you perhaps having a think about what is it that are the three things that we delude ourselves with? What are the three things that that we think are, well, that we are or that we can get out of life? Yeah? What do we think?
Success,
yeah. So wanting, wanting something. I'm looking for three specific things, but yes, it's a form of craving, yes.
Is it sort of the idea, first of all, that we're separate, that we're a separate entity, and that mm-hmm. this separate entity sort of can either have things or push things away?
Absolutely. So we think that we're unique, a separate self. Yes, absolutely. What else?
Everything is permanent.
I'm sorry?
That everything is permanent.
Absolutely. That everything is permanent. Okay? That we think we're permanent. Not only that we're permanent, but everything is permanent. Yeah? And what's the last one?
That things have an intrinsic quality or essence which is special to them.
So we could say that that we identify that there are things in the world, there are objects in the world, yes, and that we think that they have a unique essence separate from ourselves, yes. So in a way, if we've been here over the last few weeks, when we've been looking at the lakshanas, or the three marks of conditioned existence, the three things that are the marks of conditioned existence, so the things are impermanent, okay, that things just change, the things are insubstantial, that not only is there change, but things are change, so there's just this flow of phenomena. And it's our non-acceptance of those truths that create unsatisfactoriness, or dukkha. It's the ill-fitting cartwheel, the bumpy ride through life. So, and we have these topsy-turvy views, And what the Buddha says is that the way we misinterpret, the way we don't see this, is that we think that there's permanence in the world.
Yes, we think there's permanence in the world. We behave like there's permanence in the world. That's the first key delusion. That we think we are permanent. We think we're permanent in the world. And the final delusion is a little bit more esoteric, but quite obvious when you hear it, is that we think we can arrange life so that we're happy. Yes? So the three key delusions that that we kid ourselves with, yes, that put us out of step with the way things really are. So if we take, we think there's permanence in the world, what does that mean? What does that mean for us or the world? What's the obvious implication?
No change.
No change, absolutely. Absolutely. And if there's no change, what does that limit?
Progress.
Progress, yeah, absolutely. And particularly in relation to progress, what does that completely undermine?
Transformation.
Transformation, yeah, it completely undermines the principle that we can grow or develop. And if we simply look at evolution and, you know, how we've grown up to be who we are today, it doesn't make sense, does it? In a sense, to say that there is permanence in the world and that we're permanent, well, surely that... that's challenged a little bit, isn't it, by the fact that we're all here today and that we've grown up and that we've learned things and we've changed and we've grown and developed in a particular way. Yet we still believe it. Or we simply have, whilst we can see it intellectually, the challenge really is we don't believe it emotionally. And that's one of the things that we've brought out over the previous weeks when we've looked at the lectioners, is it's a deeply held emotional orientation in our beings that we want things to continue. Yes? Do we recognise that? Some muted nodding heads. Okay. So if we think we're permanent, so we think, there's simply this view. If we think we're permanent, we, you know, the natural conclusion of that is, well, we don't think we're going to die. We probably could challenge that intellectually. We see it all around us. However, we actually have the aspiration to a long, happy and healthy life, which is probably more close to it when we think about it. Yeah? So what Buddhism's saying is, well, that might not be true. It might be true, but it's uncertain. It's just uncertain. And it isn't consistent with the principle of the natural order of things, with the principles of conditionality, with the principle that everything arises in dependence on conditions. And if conditions change in the world, in our lives, you know, if climate changes, if food supplies stop, if, you know, we only need very small variations in the world for our lives to change quite radically, really. So, but to consider that, we could all end up in a state of fairly horrified anxiety. And actually, so we don't. So we don't consider that. So also, we think that there's something irreducible within me that carries on. Even if we take on the notion of that we might end, we do hold that strange notion that if I end, there'll be something of me that continues.
So we have this general trend towards eternalism, that the non-acceptance of impermanence tends to engender. So finally, with these three delusions, we think it's possible to arrange life so that we can be happy. What are the implications of that? So firstly, what do we think we can arrange so that we're happy?
People. Places.
Yeah. Yeah.
Events.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else?
It's basically sort of, I mean, they all feed into each other, don't they? So we've got more craving because we think, oh, if I just have that thing, then that'll be it, that'll be the end of it. I just need that to make me happy, and obviously then that doesn't last.
Mm.
And then sort of the whole thing goes on because it doesn't fulfil our expectation.
So there's a sense of that when we look at greed, what Subhadramati highlighted last week is it's an overemphasis of the positive qualities of an object. Yes? We sort of overinvest in what we can get out of a particular object. We have the teaching of the chocolate cake in this class. You know, it keeps on coming back. You know, we think the chocolate cake will give us quite a lot of pleasure. So we overemphasize its positive qualities, its taste, the satisfaction we'll get from it, the sense of contentment, the enjoyment of the flavor. But actually, we're entertaining a bit of a bias in our experience. It's simply a bias that we're having. And we're not considering the other half of the equation, where actually we're prone to eat a little too much chocolate cake. We're prone to feel a bit too full, maybe even a little bit sick because we've done a bit too much of it. We've not considered the weight gain. The sugar rush was enjoyable, but the insulin crash half an hour later is a bit too much to bear sometimes. But we completely conveniently ignore all of that when we're looking at the chocolate cake. But that's essentially the principle of bias in our experience. In our greed, we overemphasize the positive qualities of the object that we're looking at. Yeah. So perhaps it's best if I stop there for a moment and just see if there are any perspectives or questions. Yeah.
Stop me if this is a giant tangent, but when you were talking about eternalism and the thing that will play on, I was thinking that sounds incredibly like rebirth. From the Tibetans, I got the answer that the difference between that clinging and rebirth is what reborn isn't intrinsically you. But it kind of sounds a lot like it is. That might be off topic, but it was
praying
in my mind.
So if we think about that, because it is one of the 64 wrong views detailed in the Brahmajala Sutta. And as we're dealing with wrong views, it probably is on topic, or at least false views. It sort of leads us helpfully on to false views. I'll keep an eye on the clock just to make sure I stay on target. So this notion of something that's fixed and permanent about us that that continues forward, that sort of stuff that we've got invested in ourselves, our identity, and we sort of imagine the difference between reincarnation is the notion that our indivisible, irreducible essence carries on and puts on a new body. Yeah? Whereas in terms of rebirth, what we're looking at is a flow of conditions that are set up in this life that, as we're continuously changing, will continuously change as they're going forward.
So you could say some psychophysical energy. When we were talking about insubstantiality and flow, we were really just looking, we really got to the nub of it. It's sort of, well, the only way you can really look at it is energy carrying forward. And, well, we don't know what that is. We don't really know what energy is. We can sort of break it down into atoms, protons and electrons. I'm not a physicist. I don't claim to be. But there's that sort of thing that carries forward. And in karmic terms, what carries forward is our volitions, the sort of psychic momentum of this life. In a way, you could say, to use an image, if a branch is humanity, the whole stream of humanity, then life is like a flame burning along that branch. The branch is the same, but the flame is never the same twice. So it's sort of the energy that carries forward into the next life. And energy sort of, and volitions are always changing, affected by the conditions that they happen to find themselves in. And so it's that's more of the spirit of rebirth than reincarnation. Yes? So there's what Buddhism is saying is there's nothing fixed or permanent about us. Even when you get down to an atomic level, there's only change. What we are is temporary condensations of energy in particular forms that go on for so long until the conditions change. In our case, whatever it is that is, I suppose, genetically determined as our lifespan, and mindful of the conditions and the experience we have that affect that and interact with that, then that ends at a certain point. But that condensation of energy dissipates, yes? But then something carries forward. I would like to think of it in terms as sort of volitional energy, in a sense, psychic energy. Does that make sense?
I think I need to spend the rest of this lifetime working on it.
it's an unsatisfactory explanation because, well, we don't know what it is. We can't explain energy even. But the only thing you could probably identify it is momentum, a certain psychic momentum. But if you take the principle there isn't a cell in us that was existent when we were born, right now, that principle is alive in us throughout our lives. Yes? There is just continuous change. Does that make it a bit more tangible, even? So there's just this continuous momentum. Does that make sense? As far as it can. In a sense, you can only see this as provisional. Any explanation like this is provisional. It's just sort of pointing to the principle. If we concretize it, then we're liable to get into fixed views and wrong views. Because either we'll think that we'll start to get into there's a sort of a real me that continues, or there's nothing. That I just dissipate. And Buddhism says, well, both are not quite right. Both undermine the principle of conditionality. At the back. Yeah?
Just questioning the third delusion.
Mm.
If it's a delusion, if it's untrue, that we can change conditions in our life to make ourselves happy, that we can control that aspect.
Mm.
And what if, one goes to refuge and gives up possessions and, surely then you're creating the conditions for happiness. So, is that delusion essentially flawed in this, by simply going for refuge?
I think what happens is happiness is not the object of the spiritual life. I think that's the first important clarification.
happiness might be a byproduct, greater contentment, peace of mind, calmness, clarity, and the things that come with mindfulness, working to develop greater emotional positivity and relaxing our grip on material possessions and moving towards more qualities of generosity, of kindness, of contentment, we will find that simplicity delivers greater contentment. But we, if we take happiness as the objective, and we try and arrange our life in such a way, then we're usually disappointed. We're usually disappointed because people don't behave in the way that we expect them to. And you know, the common example that's used is lovers, and particularly how we emphasise, overemphasise their positive qualities at the beginning of the relationship, and we, as the relationship goes on, I wonder if we ever reach a point where we've got a balanced perspective with our lovers. But quite suddenly, when they don't meet our expectations, because we invest too much of what we need from them in them, quite quickly it can turn to hatred or ill will or irritation, because I am not being met. My other half isn't being my other half. They're being themselves. And but so there's all that sense of reaching but never quite being met. But we have the myth, don't we? The romantic myth that tells us that one, our equal, our other half, the person who completes us, is out there. And it's very strong. It's very strong. I'm very weak with it. But do you see what I mean? It's a slightly different perspective. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So that's just brought on a question here with relation to romantic relationships. So if one person goes, well, okay, let's just be sort of open and sort of compromise, and they're trying their sort of their best to do this, and the other person sort of like keeps going round on the wheel. Sort of, what do you do? I mean, where does the sort of because one of them is aligned with the way things are, and obviously should be more happy, but obviously they won't be because of the negative knock-on effect of the other one.
What do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what I think about that. I think that's my problem.
Yeah.
I was hoping you could tell me what you think
about it. Okay. Well, ultimately there's a decision to be made, isn't there? I don't know whether that's too blunt.
But what's the ethically correct decision?
The ethically correct decision is to stay in communication. I think that's the most important thing in any relationship, is to stay in communication, and particularly stay in communication about what is your relationship aiming for. You know, what are your needs, and you know, is it possible for you to meet them with each other? And you know, that's the start of the exploration, really, isn't it? So it's all about communication. That might sound slightly flippant, but I think that's the most important thing in relationship, is stay in communication and keep the channels of communication open and as honest as you can be, but with kindness. With kindness, because there are things that we don't talk about with our lovers, aren't there? Not everybody has, you know, in a sense, there can be fear of losing the relationship if we're really honest. Or there's a certain time when we get so frustrated, then we're very sort of critical.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Honest. Ethically, sort of, you have to take care of yourself as well. So you get to a point where sort of, I'm trying to sort of probably ask, sort of, how do you avoid that ultimate sort of like me or them thing, because then you can't do it right.
Yeah, so setting up the conditions where you're actually not sitting down in front of the TV together and pretending that that's being together, but actually in engaged in meaningful communication, and making time for that, is the only way that you're going to start to get to what's going on for each other. And actually then talking through what's important, what you value, and what's really important in the relationship starts to become easier to talk about. And actually, through exploring that, you might find actually, yeah, we're happier together, but with these limitations. Or you might decide, actually, we are going in very different directions. But then at least it's been explored, the effort's been put in, do you know where you're going? Does that make sense? Yeah?
Thank you.
I just want to spend a little bit more time on these false views, these delusions, just very briefly, just to make sure we've got the sense of what we're getting at when we're talking about a false view. Because it's not only about what we think, it's not only a belief, it's not just a thought. A view is, in from this perspective, is not just a thought, but it embraces feeling and emotional attitudes. These are deeply held emotional attitudes that govern the way we see and experience our lives. And when we've talked about greed, hatred and delusion, we've looked at those being at the centre of the wheel. False views or unhelpful views are views born of greed, hatred and delusion. Yes? So they're views whose origin starts in these three qualities, these three root poisons. Yeah? So are there any questions about that? In a sense, it's a bit of a tall order, isn't it? To start trying to deal with false views when they're sort of anchored in the three root poisons, as it were, that determine how we are in our unaware state. Okay. So there is quite a bit of ground to cover. So we'll move on to right views. Okay. Happier place. So right views. Any idea about right views?
Have a right view at the same time precisely as having wrong view. You can't feel, if you're really feeling love, there's no place in that millisecond for, or maybe even longer than millisecond, but there's no place for hatred.
And why do you think that is? Or what do you think's behind that?
Perhaps the idea that one is just expansive and fills all the kind of mental and spiritual space. There's no room for the other one.
So we're saying that if we're engaged with right view, there is no possibility for that to be in a state of greed, hatred or delusion. Yes? And to a certain extent, that's true. But there's further clarification required about what a right view is, because it's not just the opposite of a wrong view. Okay, it's not just the opposite of a wrong view. Wrong views are held with real certitude. They're sort of deeply ingrained in our sort of visceral tissue, as it were, to be graphic. Right views are held very much more lightly. In a sense, a right view is a view that's held provisionally, because it's provisional to, in a sense, a moment of insight. It's a view that's held, which with the spirit, that if, for example, if you hold a right, let's use an example, it's clearer that way. So a right view would be all things are impermanent, okay? But in that, we've still got the notion that there are things, yeah? we're still having the notion that there is some object out there. So it's provisional, so we're open to the fact that there might be no things, but we don't believe it yet. Yes, we haven't changed that deeply held emotional orientation to fix things. Do you understand? So a right view is a view which is more consistent with reality, but it's provisional. It's held lightly and not with the same certainty as a false view or a wrong view. Say, grotesque wrong view, I'm immortal. You know, clearly, really wrong. But a right view, for example, or a way of looking at it is a helpful view that brings us more into accord with the way things are, is, for example, I'm open to the possibility that I may be continuously changing. Yes?
So does that mean that sort of in a way sort of being a Buddhist and being an agnostic are sort of the same thing?
No, I don't think they are. Short
at
answer.
The moment it sounds like they are. I don't think they are, but it really sounds like they are.
Yeah. So I'm being slightly diffident on purpose because in a certain sense, being agnostic, you haven't really made up your mind, yes? Whereas being Buddhist, what you're doing is you can't have absolute certainty, but you can be open provisionally to a process of change and development, yes? Which is a slightly different thing because it doesn't involve doubt. I think in certain ways, to be agnostic involves quite a large slice of doubt, whereas you can be more certain of a process that's ongoing, but you can't be certain that there are things in that process, although you might not believe that there are not yet. Do you see what I mean? So a right view is one that's more consistent with reality, with the principle, the universal principle of conditionality. So are there any questions about that before we move on?
The way that it's taken held lightly is very interesting, isn't it? It's almost like quite a different experience from, say, dogma. Pretty much dogma.
Yes. Yes, so I think there's something that's particularly... I think this is something that Stabuti identified last time he was here on the Rambles, particularly when he was talking about the difference between Christianity and Buddhism, and that Buddhism doesn't historicise myth, and it knows the difference between myth and history. And so the likelihood for the development of dogma is much more remote. In a certain point of view, you know that myths are used to develop and ennoble and allow the imagination to take flight and to imaginatively identify with our ideal. But we don't actually make history out of them. So we know the difference between the myths that the Buddha used to elaborate principles, to teach the Dharma, but we don't make them history. So we don't make them absolute beliefs. So there's a key difference that avoids dogma in that sense, knowing the difference between your history and your myth. But valuing both, for a myth is effective or true if it works. Yeah? I forget whose definition that is, but it's not mine. Okay. So we're not finished there. We're not finished there. What we're moving towards, what we're moving or orientating ourselves towards more when we're looking at right view, is the possibility for perfect vision to arise. Okay. So what we're doing is we're orientating ourselves with right view, say the right view that we are, that we're impermanent, okay? And we're, you know, maybe reflecting on conditionality and the change that we see in our lives and all around us. So we've taken that in. We've really started to really chew that over and to look at the implications of that for our lives and for how we see the world, okay? And then we may, when the conditions are right, when we've refined our mind to a certain degree, when we've been meditating regularly, when we've cultivated stillness, we may have a moment whereby perfect vision arises, okay? And this is the real antidote to delusion. It's the moment where, I suppose the best way I can say it is that our being resonates with reality. In a sense, we resonate, we come into harmony with Dharma Niyama processes, yes? We see directly in our experience the principle of impermanence. We see directly the principle of insubstantiality. And we see directly, unsatisfactoriness, something being unsatisfactory. And we see that absolutely viscerally. Yes, we see it with our whole psychophysical being in a moment of realization. Okay, in a moment of perfect vision. What we're doing by cultivating right view, by engaging with ethics, by engaging with the karma and niyama processes, is we're cultivating, we're working towards coming into alignment more and more with the way things really are. Yes?
Can I just ask, how does this relate to the spiral path and sort of the different stages on that?
So there is a point on the spiral path where you it's a very long Pali word and I can't remember it all off pat, because it's got about 26 letters in it, but it basically means knowledge and vision of things as they really are, yes? And it's a fair way up on the spiral path, which starts with a frank appreciation that independence on suffering arises, shraddha arises faith, and independence on faith arises joy, calming down, bliss, and so on and so forth, rapture, up to knowledge and vision as things really are. And it's at that point we're talking about perfect vision arising.
That stream entry point.
Now, we may have moments of realization prior to stream entry. We could perhaps think about it as, you know, water drops in the jar, yes? And we may have moments where we become vividly aware, where energy is released and we feel, you know, vividly awake, yes? And it may come in dependence on a reflection, or it may just be an event in our life whereby we see impermanence absolutely directly. We feel it viscerally, yes? But because we're not completely emotionally positive enough, we might not be able to hold it. But you can see, actually, that, you know, once you've seen it once, it's easier to see it again. Or at least the conditions have arisen once, it's more likely those conditions, if you keep practicing, will arise again. Yes? And you can see it as sort of drops filling up a jar, and eventually that it's brimming, and it's ready, and overflows. And at that point, you know, you're entering the stream. Does that make sense? It's, you know, you can. It's not like one big moment and you're a stream entrant. You may have many smaller, you know, realizations prior to that. It's more about applying oneself to reflection on reality in the context of having a good, strong meditation practice. And engaging with the karma niyama processes. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I want to move on because we'll run out of time if I don't. And I want to say, well, how do we work towards wisdom? Yeah. How do we actually move towards wisdom? Because we've looked at false views, we've looked at the roots of delusion, we've looked at how we move towards right views, and that moment of perfect vision. But how do we cultivate that? How do we actually move forward? And we do it through the three levels of wisdom. Can anybody tell me what they are? These are the Sanskrit versions. So, anybody want to have a go? Okay. Shukra Maya Pranya. Okay. Which basically means the wisdom gained through listening. Okay? So what we're doing now. That's easy, wasn't it? So we're trying to hear the Dharma. We're trying to understand it. We're taking it in. Yeah, we're just taking it in, and we're trying to. Well, we listen. We're listening to talks. We're reading Dharma books. We're buying more than we're reading. If you're anything like that. We're keeping picking those books off the shelf, thinking, I really need that for my life. And then we never quite get to the end of it, do we? Before we've bought the next one. But we're continually engaging with trying to get a still, you know, a real taste for the Dharma. Yeah. We may even decide to learn a few words of Dharma by heart. Yeah. It's a good practice, actually, to try perhaps learn a couple of verses of the Dhammapada, perhaps those opening verses, because you only need, I might be being heretical here, but in a sense, you need to grasp the principle, but take it deeper, yes? I think Sangharakshita Bhante was very astute when he said there are no higher teachings, only deeper understandings. Yes? He was very, very astute when he said that. Because we do, you know, it's our tendency to look for that more profound thing. And then we think we're going to hear it from outside ourselves. Yeah? We think we're going to hear it from outside ourselves. Rather than realise it for ourselves, from really taking our practice deeper, from really engaging with the Dharma, in a sense, taking a little a long way, taking a little much deeper. Yeah. So, yes, we might even learn a few lists. You know, we might learn the Four Noble Truths or the Noble Eightfold Paths, and we might decide to know those by heart and then sort of look at the implications of those for our lives. And we sort of become clear that we can't go for refuge to the Buddha unless we know what he taught. In a way, what the Buddha is inviting us to do is to test his teachings. Okay, don't just take his word for it; test them. Okay, which brings us on to the next level of wisdom. But before we move on, are there any particular perspectives on that? Shrutra Maya Pranya. Or any questions? Or any other ways that we're engaging, trying to hear the Dharma?
I was actually just thinking, sort of, it actually makes sense in terms of the whole sort of, like, you need to start with yourself and the metta bhava as well, because you actually can't hear it if you've got an internal conflict. So, sort of you, because you're sort of constantly, your energy is going to trying to solve that. So in a way, actually,
to start with yourself is the way forward to actually like hearing the Dharma, sort of getting up the path, isn't that?
Absolutely. So we're just really soaking it up, really soaking it up. Getting to know, familiarizing ourselves, absolutely, yes. So, should we go to the next one? Okay. Chintamaya Prajna. Okay, what's next then? So we've soaked it up, we've learned some lists, we've got a taste for what the Buddha says. What's the obvious next step?
Meditate.
Ah, not quite yet.
Sorry.
That's all right. Same time, but yeah, absolutely. That's the next one. Yeah.
I would always say you need to live off those principles.
Yeah.
Just use them in practice in your everyday life.
Yeah. So we need to reflect, yeah? We need to live them, we need to ingest them, we need to, you know, taste the flavour of them in our lives. You know, we need to test them against our experience and see if they're true. Yes? We need to think about what we hear. Okay? There's quite a nice structure that's quite traditional about how to approach a Dharma teaching. And so we might hear some Buddhist words, but do we know what they mean? Are we clear on what Chintamaya Prajna is? You know, because we've heard it tonight. But so wisdom gained through reflection, okay? And so then we can, you know, so when we know what the words mean, do we understand what their implications, what they're pointing to, yeah? And then ask, is there anything I haven't understood about the implications? And before we jettison them completely as nonsense, you know, always take the view that there's possibly something that we haven't understood about their meaning before we completely disagree. And check them out with somebody, perhaps somebody who's a little bit more experienced than ourselves, yeah? And then, does it make sense? Ask, does it make sense? Is it reasonable? Yeah? Is it reasonable? And then, what are the implications for my life? So if we approach a Dharma teaching in this way, we'll be really quite well versed in sort of approaching it critically, positively critically, yeah? There's absolutely no problem when it comes to the Dharma and Dharma teachings with being positively critical. Yeah? In fact, it should be encouraged. In a sense, rejecting them without being positively critical is perhaps unwise. Suella, do you want to?
Are you suggesting that all of this learning is a very personal experience, so you have to listen to the Dharma and apply it, and it's just like a me in relation to the Dharma? Or do you think that a teacher in the form of another person who's more advanced down the spiritual path has a very significant role to play? And if so, to what extent can that teacher provide the right answers as well? Because they're learning themselves and they're flawed. Because they're human, and how do you learn from another person?
I think it's very helpful to see your teachers as human. Very helpful. but we do project, don't we? We do project onto people. We want our order members to be perfect. We want them to represent the ideal for us. I had that very. I was rudely. Well, rudely. Did I say something unskillful on tape? I was shaken out of my projections quite early on, with, you know, people having bad days and not being glowingly kind and warm every time I met them, and, you know, I think it's important to be in positive communication with people who are perhaps have a little bit more understanding of the Dharma ourselves. And actually, that might be just somebody who's coming a little bit longer and who knows, you know, who's heard that talk before or has heard this principle before. And in a sense, they're easier to approach than somebody like Subhuti, who's, you know, 40 years, and you think, oh, I don't, you know, he wouldn't possibly be interested in this question. He's always interested in questions, by the way. That's the way you get the best out of him if you're coming tomorrow night. So come with questions. So I suppose it's important that we recognise that there are people who are more, perhaps, more developed in terms of the Dharma, in terms of the path, more experienced is probably a better way of putting it. And in a sense, we can resonate. In a sense, we hear something, we think, yes, that's it. Yeah? And that's more of the nature of how the Dharma works. That's more how communication with Dharma works. We catch it. We and then it inspires us to follow up. Yeah? So we hear something that's inspiring and we find the energy. Our energy gets released and we want to follow it up. Yeah? And that's more of the nature of what we try and do here. Rather than have too much of a vertical hierarchy, it's more, you know, we're trying to explore the Dharma together on the basis of our individual inspiration. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's both individual, but it also is something that we can do collectively. We can help each other with through sharing experience, through communicating what we've understood. That can be very rich, actually. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I think, as well, sometimes there's a tendency, myself anyway, to kind of think, oh, the people who are teachers or senior, they must know all, and they would have the answers to my questions. But that's not a realistic expectation, is it?
Not all the time. Mm. Not all the time. However, it's perhaps helpful sometimes to have an intention to explore something and to sort of because the Dharma's not something that you can really get a hold of. We can understand the principles and people might understand the principles, but actually it's pointing to something else, isn't it? The Dharma's a path. It's a finger pointing at the moon. Yeah. It's not. You know, we don't want to jettison the path prematurely, but we also want to take on the teachings as provisional, because as our understanding develops, as our practice goes deeper, our perspectives and orientation will change, and we'll gain different understandings, deeper understandings. And then we may even go beyond that entirely as we move beyond delusion at the point of enlightenment. So in a way, we're all exploring it. We're all striving to be clearer. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, but it's not the same thing as sitting on the fence. I hope you don't get the impression I'm sitting on a fence. I don't think I am, but I think it's important to be clear that we are we're all striving individually. The spiritual life is the development of an individual. It's an individual endeavour. We might come together and explore collectively, but our own paths are as individual as we are. What we need will be different for all of us. So, Ik Bhavana Maya Pranya. So, we've taken what we've understood, we've learned something, we've taken it, we've chewed it over, we've understood the implications for our lives, or we've started to try and understand the implications for our lives, we've started trying to align ourselves with Dharmic principles. And then we come to the wisdom that is gained through meditation. So, and here, what we're trying to, and this is where the frustrating bit comes in of there's very little you can say about it. There's always that bit, isn't there? Where somebody says, and of course there's very little can be said about this. But I'm wondering if we can think of it as this is the realm of direct experience of the principles of the Dharma. This is the where we're seeing the principles of the Dharma alive directly in our experience. We're seeing the principle of impermanence alive in the breath. Yes, we've refined, we've become still, and it's there. Yes, so it's the, in a sense, we're thrown back on our inner resources at this level of wisdom. It's about how we are engaging with our practice of meditation, how we're taking that deeper, and how we're creating the stillness and refinement of mind so that reality will, that we will resonate with reality. But we've done all of that preparation before, yes? We do all of that preparation, so in the moment of meditation, we might resonate. You know, we might see something directly in our experience in meditation that is that resonates with reality, that, that in a sense we come into harmony with the Dharma, the Dharma Niyama process. Yes, when it lights up, in a sense, when we have that moment of realization, it's the whole psychophysical being at all levels is changed. Yes, it's not an understanding in conceptual terms. It's a fundamental reorientation of the, our deepest held attitudes and the way we see the world and ourselves. So, yes, it's Bhavana Maya Pranya is the realm of Shraddha, really. It's the realm of confidence, trust, trust in the teachings, trust in the path, in the principles. Because we've studied them, we've understood them deeply, and then we're just open to see the process at work in our lives. Yeah? Any questions about that? I'm being necessarily brief there. So, I think we've got 2 minutes before we finish. We've covered quite a lot of ground, really. So we've moved from delusion through this principle of non-delusion through to wisdom, through false views to right views to perfect vision. And we've done that in various different ways, whether it be through looking at how our views work cognitively, or through looking at different levels of wisdom. And if you want to sort of follow this up, then there are different ways of speaking about wisdom. And I'd recommend you look at the qualities of the five Buddha mandala, because if you want to sort of go beyond this point, really we're in the realm of qualities, the sort of qualities of the Buddhas, and particularly the five Buddha mandala. And each Buddha is associated with a particular quality of enlightenment and a particular wisdom. And so you can think about, or you can start to approach, well, what is the Buddha's wisdom? When you consider the five Buddhas and the wisdoms that are attached to each of those. So in a sense, that could be the homework. If you want to follow up, okay, so what is wisdom for a Buddha? You know, what is wisdom? Short version, it's not what you think. It's not knowledge in terms of understanding, knowledge in conceptual terms. It's more the fundamental reorientation of how the world and the universe is seen. Yeah? How the Buddha's mind embraces the Dharma Niyama process. So, we'll leave it there for this week. Next week we'll be having Subhadramati looking at Dvesha and the movement from hatred into compassion. Okay.